Hello and welcome to Technically Legal. This is podcast number 62 for August 10th, 2010. My name is David Liu, and joining me today are
Dominic Rabier
and Ben Snickoff.
So we've got three stories for you today. Starting off, a possible deal between Google and Verizon that may or may not violate net neutrality principles. Second, a story about Apple possibly patenting somebody else's app idea. And then finally, we come back to net neutrality with a possible basis for net neutrality in the Fifth Amendment. So just jumping right into the Google Verizon story, there was a New York Times article recently on the 4th saying that Google and Verizon were nearing a deal that would somehow some sort of agreement between them on how online content worked between them. So, and a lot of people were a little scared about this because of concerns about net neutrality. So the fact that Google might be getting a special deal to have their content go on the Verizon network more quickly than others is a problem directly at the heart of what people are afraid a lack of net neutrality will do. So this particular article doesn't have a lot of details about what this deal would do and or what provisions are in it. And it cites just a few scant sources, which has led to some skepticism to whether or not what the deal is, whether it actually would violate net neutrality. And in fact, shortly after the article came out, Google issued a statement on their Google Public Policy Twitter account that says, "New York Times is wrong. We've not had any convos with VZN about paying for carriage of our traffic. We remain committed to an open internet." Similarly, Verizon came out with a statement also saying that, quote, "to suggest this is a business arrangement between our companies is entirely correct." And so there's reasons to believe that there is some sort of deal between the two companies. The real question is to what? Google did not... Go
first
ahead.
Thing I'd like to chime in on saying is the Verizon statement says... the article regarding conversations is fundamentally misunderstands our purpose, and you said it's fundamentally correct. Verizon actually said in their statement, "to suggest that this is a business arrangement between our companies is entirely incorrect." So they're alleging that there is no business arrangement between Verizon and Google here.
Yeah.
I think you just misspoke. I just wanted to clear that up, though.
Yeah, that's a good point. And this is also sort of on the heels of conversations with the FCC that a lot of companies have been having to sort of work out how they want to deal with issues of net neutrality. And so the chair of the FCC, Julius Genachowski, has condemned rumors of this deal if it in fact does not comply with net neutrality. Some people were speculating that this was sort of a break off from the larger discussions with other companies, and that basically Google and Verizon were just sort of working on some arrangements of their own, separate from the larger discussion with the FCC. It should also be noted that the Android operating system for mobile phones is developed by Google, and it runs on a lot of Verizon phones. So there's a lot of space for what this deal could be. It could just be something to do with these phones. It could be something of a larger principle. So I'll open it up. What do you guys think?
Well, first thing, there were two rumors that were going around. First, that Google made a deal with Verizon to carry web traffic, and the second was that Google was in a deal with Verizon to carry mobile phone traffic, specifically traffic to mobile phones and mobile devices. And Those two have kind of been interplaying, and we're not really sure exactly which one people are denying and which one they're not denying, if any. So I just wanted to get that out there, that there seem to be two distinct deals that have been rumored, and denials that could be about one or both of them.
Right. Yeah. I mean, the thing that surprises me here is that there is an awful lot of backlash for not a lot of actual detail on what we're talking about.
Yeah, the Times article doesn't even cite, sources close to the negotiations. It just kind of states that there's been this backroom deal that's been made. And, Google has denied it. People have criticized Google's denial because it wasn't a flat-out denial. My question is, how much of a denial can you write, and how accurate of a denial can you write in 140 characters on a Twitter feed? And why did they only put that denial up on their Twitter feed? Certainly if they posted one elsewhere, I haven't seen it.
Yeah, I was watching the Google blog hoping to see something, but did not. It did say in the New York Times article, people close to the negotiations who are not authorized to speak publicly about them said that an agreement could be reached as soon as next week. Agreement about what? Who knows, but.
Right. A lot of people were pretty shocked when this news first came down, and I guess a lot of conspiracy theories were floated about, what was really going on here. The conspiracy theory that I like to believe personally is that Google leaked this to get Congress or the FCC to, kind of kick their butts in gear and actually pass some sort of substantive reform with regard to net neutrality. But it could just be that Google saw an opening with Verizon to ensure that Google traffic got to Google phones on Verizon faster than, other phones on Verizon, or faster than other services, and decided to jump on it. I mean, both of those are, in my view, plausible. Dominic, any thoughts about how likely this is, or what, if any, ulterior motives there were?
I personally think it's pretty unlikely, honestly, considering Google's history. I would be shocked if it was true, effectively. They have carefully worded their denial, though, so I wouldn't expect them to word their denial not carefully, though. So, but I don't think it's very likely, honestly.
Yeah, it does say there haven't been any negotiations about payment for that kind of thing. It may, not be cash payments. It may be, right of first refusal on new Android phones, or people at Google working specifically to help implement new versions of Android on HTC headsets or Motorola handsets.
There was another theory floated by the New York Times in a op-ed today, which was basically saying another, I mean, just it's just another theory that, Google has all these data centers around the country. Maybe this was just a deal to plop some data centers into, I think he calls it the Verizon parking lot. So more or less, it would be even faster for Verizon customers to get to Google services because it's, that much less latency. That to me seems like, I mean, that's not paying any different amount or treating the traffic any differently. It's just making it easier to get Google's get to the Google servers.
Yeah, an important thing about that is that if Verizon actually implemented something like that, putting not proxies, but backups of Google's information on Verizon's site, it would be substantially less expensive for Verizon to serve that, in addition to it being faster, because they wouldn't have to pay for all of that out traffic, then that back and forth traffic trying to get that information. David, actually, when you and I were at University of Rochester, when they implemented that Napster program,
Yeah.
they had a copy of all of the. So this was back when Napster was a pay service, when it had first gotten that. They bought licenses for all of the students at University of Rochester, and they then, I think the second year it was implemented, or maybe the second semester that it was after it was implemented, they put a server on campus with all of the songs in the Napster database, so that one, it would be much faster to serve all of the songs to people with Windows PCs because it didn't work on Linux or Mac, and they wouldn't have to pay for all of the traffic going out and back for streaming the music.
That was my first real experience with tech law, was we had somebody from, I think it was the RIAA, came and visited. I went to a talk. But
I thought it was Jack Valenti, wasn't it? I'm almost positive Jack Valenti came to the U of R campus.
I'm trying to search and find something about it. But anyway, it was a long time ago. So, I mean, that seems like it's one plausible possibility that, that, you know, it's some other deal about how to do, you know, how to make relations between Verizon and Google easier, how to make, you know, their mutual services on the Android better, possibly, that don't, to me, seem to violate net neutrality principles. But then again, we don't know. And I guess maybe we'll just have to wait this week if it is in fact released to find out what's going on. Any final thoughts on this story, guys?
All set here?
Yeah, I'm all set.
All right, so we'll follow up with that whenever we get more news about the details of this story. And now turn it over for our next story.
So our next story concerns a patent application that Apple has filed on a system and method for accessing travel services using a portable electronic device and a couple other applications. But the highlight of our story is basically there's this company out there called FutureTap that makes an app called Wear 2. And one of their apps, their app Wear 2, one of the screens from their app features as a drawing in Apple's patent application. And FutureTap was like, this looks scary. Why is Apple putting our interface in their patent application? And people were like, oh, what's this mean? I mean, they put a copy of our interface in our patent application. I've actually taken a look at this patent, and Apple is actually claiming a very specific thing in this patent application. They're basically claiming the idea of if you have a device, a mobile device, and you have a travel itinerary, you know you're going from Boston to Los Angeles, and you have someone else, say your mom, who wants to be informed of your travel status, then the idea that Apple is claiming in this patent is that when you turn off your phone, and that coincides with the time that you're going to take off, if we look at when you turn your phone back on, we can automatically notify someone and say, hey, they just turned their phone back on. That means they landed. That's the entirety of the idea. FutureTap's interface comes in as an example in the detailed description section of the application of a potential interface where this idea could be integrated into. In other words, Apple isn't claiming FutureTap's Wear 2 interface in any way, shape, or form. They're simply using that as an example of an, as they call it, an integrated application where this idea of turning on and turning off your mobile device and using that as a method to see whether or not you've landed somewhere, as somewhere that they can put that idea into practice. So at least in my opinion, in my non-professional opinion, that seems to be at the heart of this story. Basically, it's not, Apple isn't claiming their interface, isn't claiming their idea about the Wear 2 app. They're just saying that, hey, here's an example of an interface where this idea that we're claiming about turning on and turning off your phone, turning off and turning on your phone, could be used.
On the other hand, FutureTap may have a fantastic claim against Apple for copyright infringement.
That they may. They can theoretically file a DMCA, maybe not a DMCA notice because it's not online. Although I guess it is online.
They'd have to file the notice against the U.S. Copyright, Patent and Trademark Office to tell them to take down the infringement
content. but more likely they could file copyright infringement to Apple because Apple did effectively replicate their interface pretty much word for word, icon for icon, without getting their permission at all. Or even crediting them apart from the name Wear 2, which seems pretty generic to me. They do have a copyright claim potentially against Apple for this. But in terms of Apple stealing their intellectual property or patenting their app, that isn't the case here just because, first of all, their app has been out, so Apple can't patent it because you can't patent something that's known, that's been in the public. And second, Well, and if, unless you've invented it before it was in the public and you showed that you exercised due diligence. But basically, for the purposes of lay explanation, you can't patent something that's already known. And I mean, so Apple can't be trying to take their idea in this case.
Right. And in the post, and we'll link to this post in the show notes, essentially what happens is somehow this company came across this patent filing. I think it was drawn to their attention by somebody else, and they sent a series of letters to Apple being like, can you explain to us what's going on here, what's happening? And clearly, they never consulted a lawyer, because if they consulted a lawyer, I think it would have been very clear that while Apple did totally cop their interface for, you know, a diagram in this patent, nothing actually... they're not actually claiming anything that this software does. And the company, one of the people in the company who blogged about this, cites to something in the written description that describes, you know, this service that Apple is patenting can be used, you know, in part of an app that has airport services that will tell you where restaurants and ATMs and lounges and shoe shiners and information desks are in a particular airport. And underneath that, the person says, well, this pretty much describes our functionality exactly, which it doesn't at all if you have ever used Where2. Where2 finds, you know, restaurants in a city or, you know, things in a city. It doesn't find things within, you know, an 800 foot radius of you. It doesn't have maps of airports. It's, you know, absolutely not what they're claiming. And Apple, I don't think, is even claiming any of that stuff.
No.
Like Dominic said, they're claiming an ability to notify people through an app that you have landed, that you've arrived somewhere safely, and turned your device back on.
Yeah, the key in interpreting patents is basically look at the claims. The claims are the heart and soul of the patent. If a patent gets to litigation, the claims are that which matters most. Those are the magic words that define and bound the intellectual property that the patent protects. If it's not in the claims, you're not going to get protection for it. Now, if it is in the claims, you still might not get protection for it if there isn't support for those claims in the detailed description, the rest of the disclosure, the big boring text in some embodiments, and all sorts of fun stuff like that. Patentees, if you will. A dialect of legalese, as I pointed out to a friend recently. So the claims are the heart. The detailed description has to support the claims. But if it's not in the claims, it's not going to be patented. And Where2's application totally isn't in the claims at all. The claims are actually pretty narrow. They're just talking about the idea of powering down your phone and then notifying someone when you power it up, presumably because you've landed at your destination, because the program has this bit of information about you were flying from Boston to LA tonight. And in the detailed description, they say this is directed to basically providing an integrated application for accessing travel services. In some embodiments, the integrated application, in other words, where this idea is implemented, can provide all these cool services. Like, look at this schematic of this Where2 interface as we put in the diagram with the name, but without the question mark, incidentally. But that doesn't, or no, they did put the question mark, I'm sorry, but without the capitalization of the Where2. That's the only difference, sadly. It even says food and drink in the middle. And they don't like, but there's the favorite stars, there's the category circle, there's the recent without the labels underneath. But they even have the same time on the.
Yeah, except there's no preceding.
There's no zero.
Zero
before the nine. But basically, VutraTap pretty much needn't be worried about Apple patenting their idea, both because they don't claim it, and second of all, because the application has existed before the patent, so it's prior art for the patent.
Right. When I first saw this story, I actually didn't click on it because I just rolled my eyes so hard that I could not click on the story. The first headline I saw it under was like, is Apple patenting App Store apps from other people? And I was like, no, they're not. There's no way that is happening. And when I read through this, I was like, okay, maybe there's some sort of claim here. And once you dig deeper, you realize that there's just nothing going on here except for the fact that they copped a diagram, which, admittedly, pretty bad idea. You shouldn't do that. But you know, my thought was, why didn't Apple respond to this? And it's because it's totally meritless. And any response would have immediately been published, and it would have caused more hay, and I think Apple's had enough PR nightmares for the time being, so it makes sense that they just kind of step back and, you know, let the internet figure this out. And, you know, since this story was published, it has died down immensely. I haven't seen anything new about this in a while. I think it's pretty clear that this was a one-off fluke of a thing to happen.
And it's also important to mention or that these are patent applications. They haven't been granted yet. There's no guarantee they'll be granted. These are just applications. Anyway, David.
Right. So, I mean, other than them stopping, Apple stopping using the diagram in question, are there any possible legal ramifications, punishments, et cetera, that Apple would be forced to deal with here?
Other than the copyright claim on the diagram?
Well, I mean, based on that, what could happen is what I'm asking.
Up to $300,000 in statutory damages.
Let's do the entire podcast in these voices.
Yeah, I mean, that's about it. I can't think of anything else. They're not, from what I understand, they're not making any claim that they designed that they invented it, so you're not going to have any fraud on the patent trademark office. It's not, you know, I really don't see how there's any problem that would arise out of this other than a possible copyright infringement claim. And even then, I mean, it's a functional design to some extent. I don't know how successful that claim would be or how much in damages they would actually get, because it's in no way affecting the market for that app.
Okay. And I guess the other...
Yeah, I doubt people are reading patent applications and being like, oh, this is a great place to, oh, what a wonderful app. I mean, it's like, just, yeah.
Yeah, they could always opt for statutory damages as opposed to trying to prove any actual damages, of which there are none. But even then, if you're claiming statutory damages, you still have to get a jury to award you damages. And we've seen that juries can be pretty crazy, but apparently in commercial contexts, juries are less insane with damages than they are in the RIAA cases that we've seen.
So I'm also not an expert on being an app store developer, but I could also see it being possible that somewhere in the giant license agreement for submitting an app to the app store, it says we have the right to use your art. Possibly.
There is certainly that right, because they use apps in commercials all the time.
Yeah, and they reproduce screenshots in the App Store itself.
Yeah, I guess the question is how extensive is that? Is that right? I think the screenshots that they post in the App Store are submitted by the developers themselves. But you know, there's certainly the right to use the screenshots in advertising, both commercials and posters and things.
Yeah. Either way, it's decent publicity either to have your app on one of their advertisements or to make a big commotion about the fact that your app art was being used in a application.
Has anyone tried the Wear 2 app? Is it cool?
I have. I tried it when it first came out, and it was kind of mediocre. It does a lot, and it doesn't do a lot as well as apps that are more specifically tuned to specific things. Like, there's a app that, you know, this app finds restaurants, but there's an app that finds restaurants and you can dial it in by, you know, what neighborhood you want the restaurant.
Yeah, cuisine.
And then you shake it and it spins around, and I mean,
I think you have Urban Spoon.
Right. Yes. Urban Spoon. I have not used Wear 2 probably since the App Store launched.
Okay.
Is it free?
No. It's $3 right now on the App Store.
Yeah. I don't know.
$2.99.
I don't know if it was $3 when it first launched. I think it may have been free, or it was less expensive.
Cool. Anything else on this story?
I'm all set.
I keep wanting a new smartphone, or a smartphone, but that's irrelevant. So, no.
I think you're the only person on the podcast who doesn't have one.
I don't know. O'Brien's got a BlackBerry.
BlackBerry.
I don't think those count.
Yeah. Well, the torch came out, but anyway, on to our third story.
Yes, our third
Away we
story
go.
was posted Monday and caused quite a stir. So, a Boston College law professor named Daniel Lyons, and we posted about this on the blog too. And he's not that Dan Lyons, the fake Steve Jobs, different guy. Wrote an article for a law review claiming that net neutrality would run afoul of eminent domain and the Fifth Amendment to the United States Constitution. So, most people know the Fifth Amendment because it says that you have a right against self-incrimination. But it also contains a lot of other provisions. The only of which that's actually relevant, I was going to run through them and then realize that most people don't care. It says that no person shall be depraved of private property without just compensation. And what Mr. Lyons is suggesting is that net neutrality, mandating that telecommunication wires be used, that telecommunications wires specifically for internet not discriminate on based on the source of the data, that the act of regulating that would constitute a taking of that person's private property, specifically the telecommunication industry's private property, for public use without compensation from the government. There have been many people who responded to this, including Mike Masnick of TechDirt, and I think we will now proceed to rip his argument in half.
Present
Dominic?
his argument first.
Yes. Okay. So he makes two arguments. First of all, that this is a physical taking of private property. So, under the Fifth Amendment, you can do two types of takings. You can
That
do a
net neutrality is a physical taking?
yes,
That the
that a net
government
neutrality
mandating so.
regulation would be a physical
Okay.
taking.
Keep going.
First of which is the physical intrusion, which let's say there's a regulation that says you need to put a cable, breakout box on the side of all apartment buildings so everyone in the apartment building can get cable. That is a physical taking. It's a very small physical taking. It's a very small intrusion. But if the government mandates that, then they have to pay out people to, stick some physical thing on property. The next is a regulatory taking. And a regulatory taking is when you purchase a nice piece of beachfront property, and then the government says you cannot build anything on this property, and your reasonable investment-backed expectation in that property is totally gone. You bought it thinking that you would build on it, and then the government comes and says you can't build on it. It's essentially the language is it makes it devoid of all value, which And some people have argued that even that beachfront property, you can, put up a tent, you can camp on it, you can have cookouts, you can go swimming, you still have the right to exclude other people from it. So it still has some value, but it doesn't have the value that you initially thought it would. And that initial value would have been very high, and the regulation has knocked that down to virtually nothing. So Mr. Lyons' first argument, sorry, Professor Lyons' first argument is that net neutrality is a physical taking, that demanding that that electrons going over a wire are a physical trespass that the government is sanctioning, and therefore the government should be forced to pay for those physical lines and to compensate people for those physical trespasses.
Wait, you lost me. Electrons passing over a wire are a physical trespass? What?
That's his argument. That an electron passing over a wire, passing through a wire, is a physical trespass on that wire.
A physical
Remind me what
trespass
the
to who?
to the owner of the wire.
What? But they permit it. They permit the electron there.
No. So
Oh,
saying,
mandating net neutrality would therefore say if they don't want the electron there, but they have to put it there anyway, that's a trespass?
yes. And
That's not a
David Liu,
trespass.
you were chiming in.
I'm trying to just picture what the other kinds of trespass would be. I mean, imaginary trespass? Is there electronic trespass? Like, what?
So
So,
there.
in the sense that there are electrons there, yes, it's physical, but we are not physically having this conversation despite the fact that there are electrons going from Glendale, California to Boston sending Skype information. So I would not consider this a physical conversation.
And that's fair. And in fact, courts have addressed this issue before, and I think uniformly have said that electrons moving over a wire are not a physical trespass. Because then, whenever, let's say Dominic, Say that I can't ping you right now.
Okay.
Say it out loud.
You can't ping me right now, Ben.
Okay, so right now I'm pinging Dominic's server, and that would be a physical trespass under this law. And physical trespasses result in monetary damages.
I'm going to sue you, Ben. You tried to ping my server, and that's deeply injurious to me.
Right.
I demand $1 million in damages immediately.
And this is absurd. And this has been theories that have been explicitly rejected by courts because they are absurd.
For good reason.
Yes, there's no way that you could regulate this. There's no way you could physically enforce all of this. So in addition to the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, and, you know, every time you log in and violate a terms of service, you're committing a felony under U.S. law. Now you can also be charged with, you know, criminal trespass for this.
Another example is, say the Red Sox say any Yankee fans visiting our website commit trespass. And a Yankee fan visits the Red Sox website. That can't be trespass.
From both a policy standpoint and an enforceability standpoint and a realism standpoint, it's absolutely ridiculous. What courts have done is they've carved out something called trespass to chattels, which is basically a chattel is a physical object that you have. Like my mouse would be a chattel.
Or your web server.
Yes, or my web server. And if you bombard my mouse with, stones such that it's damaged, that's trespass to chattels.
Or your DOS denial of service attack the web server so that no one else can use it. It's crushed under the load.
Yeah.
That's trespass to chattel. And that's
especially if it causes damages. And
right.
Okay. That's, I was going to ask that because we could just ping Dominic entirely until he stopped, responding.
Right. And that would be actionable under law, because that's a reasonable thing to have be actionable under the law.
If you pinged me so much that I couldn't do anything else with my internet connection because it was flooded with pings, yes.
Yeah, and, there are probably other violations that come along with that.
Probably.
But that is not a physical trespass on his computer.
I think we've dealt with the first argument, that it's not, that net neutrality is not a physical trespass because electrons don't physically trespass the same way that cable boxes do. It's just a different thing. Can't be that sort of thing. Plus, there's precedent in this area that says that it's a different sort of thing that doesn't trespass the same way. Is that accurate?
Yes. So the second argument is that it's a regulatory taking. And as I mentioned before, if you want to state a claim under the Fifth Amendment for a regulatory taking, you need to say that, in this case, because of the net neutrality regulations, my communication lines are devoid of all reasonable value. And that's just patently untrue. Because, for one, the current standard is net neutrality. And do you know what? Your communications lines are not devoid of all value because of it. Okay, now that we've disposed of that argument...
Repeat that one more time.
Which part of it?
All right. So the standard is net neutrality right now.
Right. So my argument is that...
It hasn't reduced the value. Ah, okay, I see what you're saying.
Right.
So let me see if I can rehash it to make sure I understand it.
Yes.
So you're saying net neutrality is pretty much de facto right now. That's the way the internet works. It's the way it's been working. That's the case right now. You can't argue that net neutrality would diminish the value of things because net neutrality exists and it hasn't diminished the value of things.
Right.
Is that the essence of your counterargument?
It is. That then government imposition of the current norm cannot reduce the value of something that already exists. Unless you're trying to make the argument that, and I'm sorry to cut you off, that there's some value in the ability to, in the future, switch to something else. But even if there's, some value in the ability to switch to a non-net neutral standard, we've clearly established that there is still value in communications lines without net neutrality. And that imposing net neutrality as a government standard as opposed to an industry standard can't reduce the value in your lines so extensively to make them worthless.
I see what you're saying. So you're saying that it might be some sort of taking in some sort of opportunity cost way, but it's not sufficient taking to be an actionable taking under the grounds of regulatory taking.
Right.
Okay. That makes sense to you, David?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, that's all I have to say.
Okay.
So I kind of feel sorry for Professor Lyons because he's now had the entire internet mad at him, although he probably should have seen that one coming. Anybody else have any thoughts, or are we just going to wrap this podcast up early?
All set here.
So this might just be my own failure as a vague student of law and an American citizen, but when I first saw that this story, I really, for whatever reason, assumed that they actually meant the Third Amendment, which, if they had made an argument for or against net neutrality based on the quartering of troops, I would have been really impressed. But as it stands, I am less impressed.
The Third Amendment, sadly, or maybe not so sadly, has really not seen much play in the courts for the last 200 years.
I have seen it argued, though, and it was argued in a telecommunications context. Somebody uh-huh. argued that the fact that he had to put up with government-regulated radio waves going through his house was the quartering of troops.
That's creative. I'll give that points for creativity.
It is, and it was summarily rejected by the court as being ridiculous.
Creative things sometimes are ridiculous.
Such as Professor Lyons' argument.
I won't go so far.
Okay.
I don't want to libel a lawsuit.
Yeah. On that note, I think we will take this time to wrap up the podcast. So I'd like to thank you all for joining us. My name is Ben Snakekoff, and with me today were
Dominic Rabier.
And David Liu.
As always, you can visit us on our website, www.technicallylegal.org. Follow us on Twitter at TechLegal. You can send us email at podcast@technicallylegal.org. Thank you, and have a good week.